Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn more about the man known as the father of English literature. More than a century before William Shakespeare began writing his plays, Geoffrey Chaucer composed his Canterbury Tales. Unfortunately, not much is known about Chaucer's life, and the Canterbury Tales today is a book that is more read about or excerpted than actually read. Well, my guest hopes to change both of those situations with an excellent mini-biography of Chaucer. Paul Strome is the Tolkien Professor of English at Oxford University, as well as a Professor of Humanities at Columbia University in New York, who gives us more information about Chaucer's life, and for a man who was known during his life mainly as a crony of an unpopular monarch rather than a writer. He also gives us interesting insight into Chaucer's London at the end of the 14th century and how Chaucer became a pawn in the years leading up to the War of the Roses. Strone also makes a case for reading the Canterbury Tales and how the tales shed light on the people Chaucer probably knew as a customs agent in London. The name of the book is Chaucer's Tale, 1386 and the Road to Canterbury. It's published by Viking. Paul Strome is my guest today. Paul Strome, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
In telling the story of Geoffrey Chaucer, the father of English literature, I think a biographer has a tough task. You have his writings, things like the Canterbury Tales and some other pieces that survive, but there's really not much that a biographer can go on as far as surviving correspondence. All you have is his official records that he had as a civil servant. So how did you decide to tell the story of Chaucer?
Well, it happens that I'm kind of an official record nut. It happens also that there are about 500 records of Chaucer's official and diplomatic life, and not one of them mentions the fact that he's a poet. But nevertheless, they're fascinating records, and I like to hang around records and think what they might mean and think what I can do with them. So I've worked with some of these records and tried to weave them into a narrative of his life circumstances. And what that means is that I'm writing about Chaucer in the world and then only later and in conclusion about his poetry.
Well, you know, what's really interesting about this book is your depiction of what life was like for a modest nobleman, a civil servant, if you will, in 14th century London and 14th century England. Really fascinating look at this sort of time of life towards the end of the medieval period. And Chaucer was a sort of an interesting case. He was caught up in the intrigues of his age, wasn't he?
He was in a very precarious situation. I mean, he was bumping along, as you say, kind of on the edge of respectability and doing his best. He was always scrambling for money. He was never really financially secure. But beyond all that, he was also aligned with a political faction that was a controversial political faction. And he was exposed to a lot of cross currents in his life that he had to negotiate. So Chaucer couldn't be any fool and get to where he was.
Well, tell us a little bit about his background. He was the son of a wine merchant. So in the, I guess, the middle class of London at that particular time, he married
that's
up.
That's exactly right, yeah.
He did marry up.
Let me just say for a minute about that, because it's an interesting thing, is that he's sitting right exactly at the place where the middle class and the lesser gentry or, you know, lesser ranks of the nobility touch. And he comes from the bourgeois background, but at the same time, he gets a position in the court, and he's what's called an esquire, the king's household. And that's the lowest position you could occupy and feel like you had a foot on the ladder up toward the gentry or the gentle classes. So he was sitting right at the cusp. And one of the things I've always supposed is that this gave him a certain kind of latitude and sympathy that somebody who had been more squarely in a single social position might never have had.
Now, what would an esquire do exactly?
Well, he went on diplomatic missions for the king, which was very fortunate. He was never the leading member of the diplomatic party. There's a tendency among Chaucerians to want to think, oh, if the king sent Chaucer to Italy, then Chaucer must have been talking to Francis Petrarch or must have been dealing with the Pope. And actually, Chaucer went as a kind of lesser member of most of these delegations. But nevertheless, he went to France a number of times. He went to Italy a couple of times. And these trips were very important for him. So he got out and around. He also just did a lot of ceremonial duties. It was kind of a nice niche, and in some respects, he probably regretted leaving the court for the city. which is something that his political allies, I believe, insisted that he do. I think he wouldn't have done it voluntarily. So when he moved to London, I think he probably thought, oh, well, there's the end of that good part of my life.
Everything I took away from your book suggests that he was what we would call in another place and time, a functionary, if you will.
I think that's right. He made himself, I mean, my deal on Chaucer is, look, whatever Chaucer felt he needed to do to situate himself to write his poetry, I'm glad he did. But Chaucer was something of a functionary, and he made himself serviceable to the people who were running the city and who were running the nation. And they knew that Chaucer was a guy they could go to and expect him to do what they wanted him to. So in that sense, he was not a man of political courage, although, as I say, my reaction is that I'm not sure I would ask him to be. I'm not sure I wanted Chaucer to go out and get beheaded over some political issue. I'm really gladder that he was home writing his poetry.
Now, that's the other thing, is we would expect someone like Chaucer that has survived, his writings have survived for what now, over 600 years, that he was in some function a writer in the court. And you said there's very little sense that that was the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was not really a writer in the court. He wrote some poetry while he was still in the court, but not much. And it didn't seem to have much to do with his job or his position. It did seem to be handy. He knew French and he knew Italian, and they liked his linguistic skills in the court. But his writing didn't have much to do with it, and they didn't really, as far as I can tell, for the most part, know him as a writer. They knew him as a bureaucrat and a civil servant. And throughout the first two-thirds of his career and the first two-thirds of his life, his identity as a civil servant was much more prominent than his identity as a writer.
Now, there are several documents that do survive that give us a sense of where Chaucer was. And one of those was a decree from the king that he would get a measure of wine every day. And
yeah.
and there was another one that he would have a place to live. That came from the city of London. And also a salary of £10 a year, I think that was, which was a great deal of money.
At its best, £20.
Yeah.
These are all examples of the kind of records we were talking about. Yeah. That is, we do have these records. And the question is, okay, you've got these separate facts, and how do you turn these facts into some kind of a story? And what I would say is that, okay, they're giving him what they call a pitcher of wine on the waterfront every day. They're giving him a rent-free apartment in the city of London, and they're giving him an annuity. What this means to me is they wanted him in this job. They were going to do things to compensate Chaucer for doing a job they wanted done. And so I take these isolated facts and I say, look, there were powerful people who wanted Chaucer in this place at this time, and the records prove it. And I go on to suggest that the reason they wanted him in this place at this time is because a lot of money was being made on the waterfront, and they put him in as controller of customs on the waterfront, and his job was to look the other way. So Chaucer showed up. And by the way, another interesting thing about the pitcher of wine.
Perfect job for a poet.
Yeah. Well, the thing about the pitcher of wine is, for one thing, it's a lot of wine. It's over a gallon. And so it's worth something. He presumably didn't drink it all himself. And eventually he was able to translate it into kind of a cash annuity. But the thing about it was he was supposed to collect it daily there on the waterfront. So they wanted him there. They wanted him on the job. But the reason they wanted him on the job, as we're saying, is so he could wave a lot of stuff through that a more rigorous controller of customs probably wouldn't have agreed to.
Now, I've also read other accounts, and I think this may be sort of looking back in time to say that that annuity and that wine ration was a sense of his value as an artist or a writer. And you say that was absolutely not the case.
Not a shred of evidence.
Yeah.
There's no evidence that he ever earned a penny, or I should say a farthing, from his writing. And the reason he got these annuities is because of the political jobs he took, and a certain compliance in those jobs. And also, and this goes back to something you started to ask me about at the beginning, through his marriage to Philippa Chaucer, who was the sister of Catherine Swinford, who was the mistress of John of Gaunt, the most powerful man in England. And Chaucer got annuities based on his job, and he also got annuities based on the fact that his wife Philippa was so well connected, and he got a few crumbs off that table.
Yeah, and John of Gaunt was actually the father of who would become Henry IV, who would succeed Richard II.
Yes, indeed.
But in fact, as you write in the subtitle of the book, 1386, leading up to this day, he becomes a part of this widespread hatred of Richard II. Richard II was a spendthrift. He was not particularly successful in the battlefield, so the Hundred Years' War was not going well. Basically, Parliament was pretty much fed up with him.
They were indeed. They were fed up with Richard II, and they were fed up with his supporters in the city of London, one of whom was Geoffrey Chaucer.
And in fact, the actual, I guess it would be the person above him, he was sort of a customs agent or a controller. The actual person that controlled the customs was very much a part of Richard II's circle.
A very powerful man named Nicholas Brimber, and he was mayor of London, and he was collector of customs, it's called, and he's the one who was making the money. And interestingly, for the life of Chaucer, Nicholas Brimber is one of several persons close to Chaucer who were beheaded as a result of parliamentary action in 1388, 2 years after the year we're talking about. So the fact that Chaucer got out when he got out, and one of the interesting questions here that I take up in my book is when he leaves London in 1386, is he thrown out of London or did he prudently leave London in order to save his own skin? And you can make either argument. The argument I make is that he was thrown out, but it was fortunate for him that he's thrown out because some of his close associates, including his boss, were executed in 1388 because of their unpopularity.
Now, why was he thrown out, do you suppose? Was it? I think the book sort of explores the fact that because he really just was a functionary of sorts, he was not a vehement supporter of Richard II. They put him up for Parliament, and you, as you write in the book, says this was incredibly unusual. Members of Parliament, even though it wasn't the law, it was the custom that you had a land, you know, some lands, and you came from that place.
Yes, Chaucer was one of the more humbly situated members of Parliament. They call his category in Parliament the category of Shire Knights, and about half of them are knights, and the ones who aren't knights are well-positioned. Now, there were also middle-class members of Parliament who came as burgesses or representatives of the cities, but Chaucer was there as a Shire Knight, and Chaucer was by far the least prosperous and least influential of the Shire Knights in Parliament, so it's pretty clear they put him in Parliament again as a political maneuver.
And as 1386 comes into being, this is when all of this sort of revolt that's going to show up a couple of years later is starting.
The early
really,
signs. Yeah. And I think Chaucer is, I think Chaucer's expulsion from his job and from the city is a sign that he was regarded as being sort of on the outer fringe of these politicos who are getting in trouble. That is the one of the more vulnerable and conspicuous of their members. And I think his unpopularity and his departure from the city in 1386 is one of the early warning signs of what was going to happen to these guys. But as I say, it's wonderful for Chaucer that he got out when the getting was good.
Yeah. My guest today is Paul Strohm, the Tolkien professor of English at Oxford and a professor of humanities at Columbia University. His book is titled Chaucer's Tale, 1386 and the Road to Canterbury, published by Viking. And not only telling the story of Geoffrey Chaucer, you also give us a great sense of what London was, the city of London in that particular day. And we have to remember there was distance between Westminster, where Parliament was and where the king was, and the city of London in that day. And it's a really amazing portrait because you tell us that Chaucer lived, he had an apartment. The city of London gave him a small place in the Aldgate, which is a gate into the city.
It's one of the gates out of the city.
Yeah.
And he had a room over the gate.
Yeah, and it wasn't, as you said, it was not spacious digs. It was probably pretty plain, dank, and probably unpleasant.
Well, one of the things I say in this book, I think people have assumed that it was quite a perk to get this apartment. And of course, you get a rent-free apartment in London, it always is some kind of a perk. I mean, I wish somebody would give me one.
Right.
But nevertheless, I go into some records, some of which haven't been looked at before, that suggest it was a fairly cramped and uncomfortable accommodation, and it was noisy. And, of course, there's sort of a rule, you know, when you write about the Middle Ages and you write about London, you've got to say it's dirty and noisy and smelly. And, in fact, yes, it is dirty and noisy. I get that out of the way fast, but I do include it because it's not only expected, it's true.
Now, describing just the location, this was the gate was a place where traitors to the realm, his head would be rotting slowly outside the wall.
A certain spillover. Yeah, it wasn't Aldgate wasn't the favorite place to put traitors' heads, but it was a place to put traitors' heads, and it became increasingly popular. So when there are illustrations of the city of London and sketch maps and drawings of the city of London in the 16th century, they always show traitors' heads over Aldgate. As to when they started doing it, whether they were already doing it in Chaucer's lifetime, I'm not absolutely certain, but I think, yes, there were traitors' heads up on his roof. Hmm. And there are traitors' heads on the roof, and there's a very smelly city ditch down below, and the carts that entered the city through the gate tended to have iron-bound wheels and were very noisy, as you could imagine. And so I think there was a good deal of smell, and there's a good deal of racket going on around Chaucer. So it was not a perfect place in which to write poetry, despite the fact that he wrote a good deal of nearly perfect poetry in it.
Mm. You said London in that particular day and age, no privacy, really very little privacy at all.
Very little. I guess that's one good thing you can say about living in a fortified tower over a city gate, is it's it was small, noisy, and crowded. However, it was also, in a certain sense, rather isolated, and he would have had more privacy than most people in London had. In fact, he writes about that in one of his poems, and it's a very funny poem that people don't read much nowadays, although I wish they would, called The House of Fame. And an eagle picks Chaucer up in his claws in this poem and takes him on a sort of tour of the universe and harangues him the whole time. And one of the things this eagle accuses him of is just when he gets through, as the eagle says, keeping his accounts during the day, he goes home to his rooms, and he just sits up there in his apartment with a book, as silent as any stone, and doesn't mix with any of his neighbors in the way that most of the people in the city of London in the 14th century were mixing. And you never know when a poet portrays himself in his own poetry whether he's being strictly accurate or not, but I think in this case he probably is. I think he probably would go up to his room. I mean, he had to write that poetry sometime. I think he would go up to that room and close the door, and he led a rather isolated life there. But while he was living, he lived over the tower for 12 years, and in those 12 years, he wrote most of his major poetry up to the Canterbury Tales.
Yeah.
Although it was only when he left the city that he began the Canterbury Tales.
And I'm gathering from your descriptions throughout the book that a lot of these Canterbury Tales are based on some of the things he saw in London, some of the people he met when he would be an emissary to the continent during the wars. It might be the basis for the night. Family members could be some of the other members. We talked just briefly about him marrying up with Philippa. Her sister, Catherine, John of Gaunt. And we should also mention, he really lived apart most of his life from his wife. If they weren't estranged.
He did live apart from his wife. As a matter of fact, if I may, I'd like to tell you where I first started writing this book. I found a record that said that his wife, Philippa, in the spring of 1386, was initiated into the most prestigious social fraternity in the land. It was a social organization, and it was the Friends, in effect, of Lincoln Cathedral. And at her initiation ceremony, the future Henry IV was also initiated as a friend of Lincoln Cathedral. And King Richard himself, the next year, made a special trip to Lincoln Cathedral in order to be initiated into this fraternity. So anyway, it was a highly prestigious thing. And the guest list for this occasion survives. And it says that, and it names, you know, 15 or 18 or 20 people who are present at the ceremony, people who were inducted into the fraternity, and then also people, you know, prestigious spectators. And it says there were a bunch of other onlookers, incidentally. Now, the interesting thing is it does not name Geoffrey Chaucer, and it's possible that he could have been among the onlookers, but it doesn't appear to have been the case. He was probably down in London. And what I started thinking about was, okay, here's his wife being initiated into the most prestigious social organization in the land, and here's Geoffrey Chaucer absent and probably down in London holding down his job on the waterfront. And what a discrepancy that is. And so I started trying to imagine what Chaucer's solitary life in London was like while his wife was hanging around with the creme de la creme.
As we mentioned earlier, about 1386, this is the year it all changes for Chaucer. The foes against the king in Parliament are becoming far more open, And he is an early casualty, probably because he's not so well connected, and he's sort of a functionary and sort of an easy victim.
He would have been a vulnerable target. That's quite right.
So he not only loses his customs agent's position, he also loses his lodging because all of a sudden Parliament passes a law that, you know, he was granted that for life, and all of a sudden says, no, not so much.
Yeah, there are two laws. Parliament passes a law saying that nobody should be controller of customs, rather, indefinitely. Uh-huh. And Chaucer had been in the job a long time, and if it wasn't specifically aimed at him, it was aimed at people like him. But he was the most conspicuous representative of the category of persons at whom this resolution was aimed. At the same time, it was the officials of the City of London, more or less in coordination, who bounced him out of his apartment. And they pulled a maneuver where on one day the city council passed a resolution saying that nobody could continue to live in these apartments on the basis on which Chaucer was living there, and that Chaucer would have to move out along with everybody else. And then the very next day, after Chaucer had presumably moved out, they turned around and appointed somebody to that apartment on the very same basis. So it really looks like all that had been about getting rid of Geoffrey Chaucer.
And so he moves to Kent, and no real land to speak of, no home, really.
Where he is, yeah, right. Yeah.
And so he's right. Bouncing around, and this is when he begins writing the Canterbury Tales.
Yes.
How much of the Canterbury Tales are based on the people that he ran into in his official duties in and around London, in and around court?
Well, I wish I could say yes to that. It would make a great story. But Chaucer is a very literary man, and his sources tend to be literary sources. There aren't too many direct portraits of people he knew inside the Canterbury Tales. There are a few, though, and the host of the Canterbury Pilgrimage, and the guy who controls the tale-telling, is a man named Harry Bailey, and he is the proprietor of the Tabard Inn. And in fact, city records have established that there was a guy named Harry Bailey who was the proprietor of the Tabard Inn. And so there are some contemporary faces and some actual contemporary people there in the Canterbury Tales, although I think what happens more with Chaucer is just that with his enormous social latitude, he has a kind of openness to general social types, and he's less interested on the whole in including specific portraits of individuals than he is on representing kinds of people. And he's very acute about kinds of people. The sociologist Weber, I guess, would have called them ideal types. And he gives us an ideal case of a knight, or an ideal case of a nun, or an ideal case of a
friar,
gardener, or what have you. Now, when I say an ideal type, what I mean is the perfection of the kind of person they are. I don't mean that they are necessarily virtuous people, because one of the interesting things in the Canterbury Tales, of course, is he includes a whole lot of ideal examples of extremely unvirtuous people.
Roguish behavior, yes.
Right. And I'm not sure that I think there might be composites rather than based on individuals, but it's his keen eye toward the individuals among whom he lived that enables him to create these composites.
Well, I was struck by something when you were writing about London that caught my eye, and that was the fact that along with no privacy, the currency of the street was gossip, and gossip could easily get you killed.
Yes, indeed. Well, it did get some people killed. Chaucer had a friend named, an acquaintance named Thomas Usk, who was a kind of scrambling writer who wanted to live the kind of life Chaucer was leading. And he was a pretty good writer, although his main book survives. And I'm disappointed at how few people read it, called The Testament of Love. But anyway, Thomas Usk was trying to live the life of Chaucer as best he could. And at exactly the point at which Chaucer either was expelled from the city or decided to leave the city or both, Thomas Usk was involving himself more and more closely with this faction with which Chaucer had previously been associated. And Thomas Usk is one of the people who was beheaded in 1388. He's the closest example of somebody who was trying to live a life like Chaucer's and who was, in fact, one of the handful of excellent literary people and writers of the late 14th century, and he got his head cut off. Hmm. In fact, they not only cut it off, they cut it off with 27 strokes of a dull axe.
Whoa.
if you were a highly favored person.
Yes, you got the sharp axe and the good executioner.
His friend Simon Burley was beheaded in 1388, and they brought in a special executioner from France with a sharp axe as a favor to him.
Well, the book is really interesting because it gives us a sense of what life was like in the late 14th century. It also tells us a great deal about Chaucer. And yet, the thing is we have to remember, this is a book, Canterbury Tales became famous after his death.
Yes.
Maybe a couple hundred people may have known that Chaucer was a writer during his lifetime.
That's my guess. I'd put it in the hundreds, knew that he was a writer at all. And nobody had seen the Canterbury Tales because it was put together from fragments after his death. And the first versions of the Canterbury Tales. And if you look very closely at the Canterbury Tales, you've probably seen people carrying around the Canterbury Tales, or if you hang around college English classes, and it looks like a book. But it's actually a simulated book, because the Canterbury Tales are about 90% complete. And scribes and editors put it together in the decade after Chaucer's death in a way that gives it the look and feel of a complete book. And Chaucer did, in fact, write a beginning and an end. So its incomplete places are in the middle. Canterbury Tales doesn't exist until the decade after Chaucer's death, and only then it exists as a patchwork, a brilliant patchwork, but still a patchwork. And so Chaucer had no celebrity based on being the author of the Canterbury Tales in his lifetime, sad to say.
And yet within 100 years it was widely read?
Yes, yes. In fact, even within 15 or 20 years it was widely read. Mm. It got around very fast when it got around, but too late for Chaucer to live off of it.
Of course, written in Middle English, the Canterbury Tales, even to this day, is a book that's more read about than actually read.
I want to tell your listeners that yes. Middle English isn't as hard as they think it might be. start looking up a few words.
Yeah, it's
pretty soon it looks familiar. But I do have a recommendation to make.
So, do you have an edition that you can give that gives readers a sense of?
Well, here's my recommendation, and I'm delighted to have a chance to make it on the radio and have some people hear it. Is that I think the best way if you're coming to Chaucer fresh, if you're not studying him in a class, but you just think you might want to read some Chaucer, I think the best way to read some Chaucer is in what they call an interlinear edition. That is where you have the line of the Middle English, and then immediately below it you have the line in Modern English. And so you can read through, and you can read it in Modern English, and then when you come across a line that particularly interests you, you can look up at the Middle English and see what it was, or vice versa. You can read the Middle English, and if you get stuck on a line, you can look down at the Modern English. And it's very easy to get hold of an interlinear edition of the Canterbury Tales, and for free. And that is, there's a Harvard University website that has an interlinear edition of Chaucer on it that's completely open to the public, and they encourage people to visit. And all you've got to do is in your search engine, you type in Harvard and Chaucer, and it comes up. So you don't even have to know a fancy address. And search engine, Harvard, Chaucer, and the site comes up. And on the site is an interlinear edition, a very good one, of the entire Canterbury Tales.
All right. Well, the name of the book is Chaucer's Tale. Paul Strome, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Paul Strome is the Tolkien Professor of English at Oxford University, as well as a Professor of Humanities at Columbia University in New York, and the author of Chaucer's Tale, 1386 and the Road to Canterbury. It's published by Viking. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.